where silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We're delighted to welcome this afternoon students from Rock County Christian High School. If they stand, please. Wow, be good. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Have you received briefs of this case? No? You have. Good. If anyone needs a summary of the case that we're about to hear, Deputy Marshall will provide one if you raise your hand. All right. We're all covered. We're delighted to see you. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. And seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to Justice Prosser and to my left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my right is Justice John Wilcox. And his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience. All right. Introductions being made, I'll call 03-2820 CR, State versus Ofterhauer. Thank you. Arguing on his behalf is Attorney Ray Kreck. Mr. Kreck.
Good afternoon. It's nice to see you all again. Greetings from Jefferson County, Wisconsin. My name is Raymond Kreck from Kreck and Brandmeier, and as the Chief Justice noted, I represent the appellant defendant, Mr. Ofterhauer. This is a case of fundamental fairness from our perspective. It is a case that focuses on how a juvenile case, a juvenile delinquency case, will begin in terms of the court's personal jurisdiction over the juvenile. We believe that the case of Jermaine T.J., and I'll try to refrain from making jokes about what's Jermaine and not, is a case that has created a crack in the door in terms of fundamental fairness. And we disagree with the position of the state that that door should be opened wider and wider. The case of Jermaine T.J. basically stood for two propositions. One, that there's no clear legislative intent that failure to comply with juvenile service statutes will result in dismissal with prejudice. And second, in Wisconsin, an illegal arrest is not a jurisdictional defect. In this case, there is absolutely no question that the District Attorney of Walworth County and the presiding judge of Walworth County wholly failed to follow the mandate of Section 938-273 of the Wisconsin statutes regarding service of the summons and petition that commences a juvenile court action. The summons and petition were filed. Summons and petition were filed within a matter of months after the alleged conduct. The summons and petition were sent to various addresses. Mr. Ofterhauer did not appear for his initial appearance. Then the court did not, in any way, follow the requirements of Section 938-273 of the Wisconsin statutes.
Counselor, was he ever mailed by certified mail the documents from juvenile court?
No.
Thank you.
What the court should have done is ordered the matter adjourned under the requirements of 939-273 sub 1. It should have then determined probably with input from the district attorney, how to obtain service on Henry and his parents. The DH case from back in 1977, which the Chief Justice is quite familiar with, I'm sure, requires that fundamental fairness means making sure that the parents and the child and anyone else intimately involved in the case know what the charges are, be served with the process, and then make an initial appearance before the court.
Mr. Crack, let me interrupt you, if I might, at this point, just to clarify something. You said that the summons and the petition for delinquency were filed.
Yes.
And they were sent to various addresses.
Yes.
Now, I know that at least one of those addresses, the summons and petition came back undeliverable or something along those lines. Did all of them come back, or did some of them end up not being returned?
Some did, some didn't. And the problem is that you've got at least three addresses out there. The Court of Appeals case says that Whitewater is in Walworth County. That's a small error. It's in both counties. It's both in Jefferson and Walworth counties, for those of us who live there. And the reason this all started out in Jefferson County is that the Ofterhauer family, which had been planning for about 2 years to move, was living in an apartment which had vacated. That apartment was in Jefferson County. That's one address. There is a rural route address. The Ofterhauer family lived in a rural Montana area, miles away from town, and there's a post office box address. There's also a school address, which the police officers, both district attorney's office, and the court knew about. So there were multiple addresses at which this defendant was available, and as the Court of Appeals noted, there's no reason in the world contact couldn't have been made. But getting back to your answer, some came back, some didn't, which should have raised the flag. We aren't getting the message to young Mr. Ofterhauer or his parents.
Now, the reason, as I understand it, that you're concerned about the Germaine T.J. case is that that case would seem to indicate that jurisdiction goes to the juvenile court upon the filing of the petition. Is that correct?
That's the way it was read by the Court of Appeals, and that's the way the state wants you to read it. We disagree. Okay. We believe that jurisdiction is of course, initiated by the filing of a summons and petition. That happens in civil cases and criminal cases, but to initiate the case and perfect personal jurisdiction, you have to get the process to the individual, and you have to ensure, by, we would think, a third-party means that the individual got it. And that could be certified mail if he doesn't show up in response to the regular mail. That could be by a process server.
At least one of the petition summons combination did not come back. Wouldn't that indicate that the juvenile and or his parents received it?
No, not necessarily. Any number of things could happen. And the point is that the Wisconsin legislature made a very clear mandate on how to get personal jurisdiction over a minor. If the regular mail goes out and the minor doesn't appear, which is what happens, there are steps that the court shall take. Step one, adjourn the case. Step two, determine whether or not it's practicable or not practicable to serve him by normal means, a process server, the sheriff, registered mail. That determination was never approached in any way whatsoever by the trial court. They ignored it. They issued a capias, it went in a file, and that was the end of it. And the court, then the case lied dormant. So the legislature's clear, absolutely clear mandate on what to do to get the juvenile personally before the court so that, as you know, as a trial judge, you want to be looking at that defendant and say, do you know what you're charged with? Did you get the summons and complaint? And now we're going to set up do you have a plea? And are we going to set a hearing? That's a simple due process of law. If the trial court doesn't follow 938-273, we flip the case around and we put the burden under the Flores case, which really has nothing to do with this, on the child to prove that he didn't get it. The parents to prove that they didn't get it.
How, correct, if I could interrupt. You're talking about receiving, and I want to go back to the statute itself, and I want to ask a question about the very first sentence in the statute. 938-273. Service of summons or notice required by 938-27 may be made by mailing a copy thereof to the persons summoned or notified. Now, as I understand the facts of this case, at the time the summons was filed, your client was already living in Montana. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was service ever sent to Montana?
Yes.
Of the initial filing?
Yes.
At some point.
Well, service, I don't want to. I think what Justice Butler is asking, did you send the initial mailing, I believe, was made in two places. It was made, first of all, in, I would say, Whitewater and in Montana.
Yes.
Now, the state is arguing, and I don't, Justice Butler, if you haven't, I just wanted to pick up, the state is arguing this sets up the rebuttable presumption, which is under the Forrest case. So you're saying that has nothing to do with this case. That's different.
And I say it this way. You can start a small claims action by sending out mail. Because that's all it says you have to do. But we have a statute here. We have a statute that ensures that the individual, proven by a third-party basis, has gotten the startup papers for the juvenile delinquency action. This is a case, any of these cases have to do with liberty. They have to do with the possibility of having a criminal record. To say that you can just simply send this out like a notice that you've won the Reader's Digest sweepstakes instead of ensuring that the juvenile has been brought to the, you know, the court wants you to know that you are the object of our work. Yeah, and you've got a procedure. Adjourn the case. I mean, this procedure was simply not followed by the trial court.
Correct, if I could, because maybe I'm confused by your brief, and maybe I'm misunderstanding you, and I want to make sure we're on the same page.
Sure.
When I look at page 6 of your brief, yes. The initial summons and the delinquency petition were sent to the Whitewater address. As I understand it, it was the waiver petition that was sent to Whitewater and Montana. Am I reading that incorrectly?
You're not. I think there was also, though, somewhere along the line, a mailing of the petition at the beginning to two addresses. But the point is that it is not mailing that creates personal jurisdiction. It's the appearance of the juvenile before the court, and that needs to be ensured by the court.
Well, the reason I'm asking the question is, if we disagree with you, and mailing is sufficient, you still have to take the step of mailing. And if the mailing never went to the Montana address of the initial petition, how do you get to the rest of the statute?
Well, then the court has never had any jurisdiction.
That's what I'm trying to ask you about.
You didn't even get to first base.
And maybe I'm misconstruing your brief, because as I read your brief, what you seem to assert is that the initial petition and summons went to Whitewater, and the waiver petition went to Montana. And if I'm reading that wrong, please correct me.
I'm going to have to try to remember the facts. A Whitewater petition did not come back. A petition to Montana was returned undeliverable. What I'm saying, that it doesn't make any difference. We can't rely on the Postal Service in situations this important. When the juvenile doesn't appear, then, and there's been some mailing, whether diligent or not, by the district attorney, the next step is to adjourn the case, and they absolutely knew where he was, they knew what school he went to, they knew his address, and they knew his post office box. The next step is serve him. Period. End of subject. There shouldn't be any lack of clarity about that, there shouldn't be any question. Because the function of service is to get into that courtroom and say, young man, you have a problem that you have to address with this court, and we want to help you. Until that happens, we believe that fundamental due process is not served. And the thing is taking Jermaine and suggesting that you can do anything less, that you can't do anything about prosecutorial negligence, lawlessness or something like that, if the court and the DA don't do their job, you can't do anything about it, doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of fundamental fairness.
Now, there was a finding here by both the trial court and basically by the Court of Appeals that the state goofed up. Basically, they've said the state was negligent. Judge Kennedy said that, and Judge Bergeron in her opinion. But she said, notwithstanding that, you still have the Montgomery case, which basically says unless it's intentional, you still don't get over the hurdle. In other words, the state, there was no showing here that this was intentional. There was a finding of negligence, and even after the scolding the Court of Appeals gave, they still came down that the Montgomery case is valid.
I believe we're going to now mix an apple and an orange here, so I have to unmix them for you. We have two issues here. One is personal jurisdiction in not having young Mr. Ofterhaar get into the court one way or another. The other issue is a year-and-a-half delay in the waiver petition.
Okay.
And that's what the Montgomery case has to do with. Now, in the Montgomery case, the kid was 17 years old.
He's now, what, 19?
My client?
My client's
19. But in the Montgomery case, the kid was 17. They delayed about a month. He became 18. And the court said, well, that's not, that little negligence is not enough to take away the power of the court to waive this child into adult court. That's so far afield from what we're doing here that it doesn't count. We're talking about in not following the procedure of 938-273, simply official unlawfulness, I think it was used as a term. And that can't be condoned to the damage, to the detriment of the rights of a juvenile who, because of that combined with the delay, finds himself in a situation, you say he's 19 years old now. If we allow this negligence, we allow this official unlawfulness, then what happens is someone who is 15 and a half when he allegedly committed these assaultive acts on classmates now is 19, and it's now as though a 19-year-old committed those acts on a 15-year-old because we stopped the clock on the events, but we let the clock run while, as the Court of Appeals says, the district attorney sat on his hands.
Counselor, if we were to agree with you that there was no personal jurisdiction here in juvenile court, that would mean that the waiver was invalid. What follows next? Do you dismiss the petition? Can it be refiled? What's the remedy?
The remedy has to be dismissal here.
Why?
Well,
dismissal with or without prejudice. I mean, that's one of the questions
prejudice.
I have. Why?
Why? Because the whole structure of 938 is to act quickly. The juvenile justice system is to take young people, get their attention, and get them help so that as adults they don't do things that they did in their youth that they might learn earlier. Because we do a lot of things when we're young that if we learn early on, we won't do it again.
Counselor, in most cases that I'm familiar with, when the court finds no personal jurisdiction, the dismissal of the whatever followed from that lack of jurisdiction is never with prejudice. You can always refile. Unless the statute's run. So I'm asking, I mean, my understanding of personal jurisdiction is that you don't get a dismissal with prejudice.
If the court doesn't file a complaint, I think it's so many days, it loses jurisdiction in a juvenile case. It loses that jurisdiction. And if the court doesn't follow through expeditiously and get the process that initiates the action served, so the personal jurisdiction aspect is there, the case should be dismissed. And the thing is that the child shouldn't be essentially punished for the failure of the court to follow the statute, for the failure of the district attorney.
Let me just try to get you back on what's bothering me. Okay, this young man is 19. Obviously, you can't file a delinquency petition against him because he's outside the scope of the authority of the juvenile court. Can you still file a criminal complaint against him based on the activities that occurred when he was a juvenile?
Independently of this, I do not believe so.
Why?
Because the court failed to follow the procedure when he was a juvenile, failed to waive him into adult court, it lost its opportunity for jurisdiction. The state lost its
opportunity for jurisdiction. That's the juvenile court. And I have to say it's not an argument that I thought anybody addressed, but it's obviously bugging me.
I frankly haven't thought of it before this moment. I'm not relying on investigating it recently. I guess I'm
years of experience, right?
See, I guess I go back, and if I say I buy all your arguments, I say there's no personal jurisdiction. So you couldn't waive them into adult court. Well, that's one part of the picture, but there's the rest of the story, as that guy always likes to say on the radio, and I'm wondering what's the rest of the story. You get to file in adult court and can't file in juvenile court because he's too old now. But you don't know. If you don't know, it's a fair answer, Mr. Crack. You don't have to. I don't want to take your time up with it.
You
got
an unqualified.
I don't know either, so. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thus, if there's no personal jurisdiction, is there any need to get to the second issue in the case and tackle the Montgomery case? And
Probably not.
But maybe Montgomery is the answer to the questions you're asked. In Montgomery, they never filed in the juvenile court, right?
In Montgomery, they didn't.
He turns 18. They then file in adult court. And the holding is that if it's not an intentional stalling to get him into adult court, then it's okay to bring him in adult court, right? So why can't you say here they didn't have personal jurisdiction, the waiver was ineffective, but assuming that there's still no statute of limitations running, and I don't know if there is or is not, they can bring him into adult court under Montgomery.
Because that would be fundamentally unfair.
But isn't that a different argument in a different case?
It deprives Mr. Ofterhauer of his constitutional right as a 15-and-a-half-year-old to be treated as a juvenile like other juveniles. The state had the opportunity to give him the benefit of the juvenile court system to help him to get in treatment. If the state fails to follow clear statutes, fails to do what it obviously can and serve him, then Mr. Ofterhauer is denied the benefit of the juvenile system. If we just wait to prosecute people as adults, why have a juvenile system?
But will that require us to overturn Montgomery?
It will require the court to clarify Montgomery, because Montgomery is a very much different situation. We've got a child a month away from 18, a 17-year-old under the current state of the statutes, we could start up a criminal case. Here we had a 15-and-a-half-year-old who could have greatly benefited. If you look at the respondent's Appendix 136, which is the report of the social worker, it starts out, that's RAP 136, second page of this is the report on April 22nd, 2003 that was at the hearing when the waiver occurred in absentia. The juvenile has not had the benefit of any long-term pharma services to date. At the time of the current allegations, he was 15 years old and would have been a good treatment candidate. Given the fact the juvenile fled the state, and that is absolutely not true, there's nothing in the record to indicate that, while the matters were pending and is currently 17.8 years old, there are no viable alternatives for services and accountability within the juvenile system. My client has been deprived of the benefit of the juvenile system. There's no reason, there's no rationale, there's no fairness in that having occurred.
Counsel, that gets me back to my question, and just help me if I might be all wrong on this, but it seems to me if you prevail, and who knows if you will, but if you prevail, that there is no personal jurisdiction, the first question, then how do we get to the second question? The second question deals with waiver. Assuming there's personal jurisdiction to begin with in juvenile court, you don't have waiver unless you have that threshold jurisdiction. So it seems to me that the argument is if you don't have personal jurisdiction, case is dismissed. And then, then the county may wish to start an adult prosecution, and then there will be defenses, and there might be extradition and all this sort of stuff, but that's another day.
But I don't think so. I think I'm now getting to the answer of Justice Rogensack's question. If they delayed for 2 years to take any action and deprived this 15-year-old of the juvenile system because of pure state, I'm going to call it so far as, well, certainly unlawful conduct and certainly negligent conduct, then they've deprived him of his rights as a citizen of the state of Wisconsin to treatment in the juvenile court and the benefit of the juvenile court without any good reason, and therefore it should be dismissed with prejudice and it should not be allowed to be prosecuted as a criminal case.
It seems to me you want to hit a home run. I'm never that clever. But this is a case that involves just first base, just a single. Do you have personal jurisdiction? The answer is yes or no. You know, I mean, it's not that easy, but the answer is yes or no. If you do, then you get to, okay, was there waiver? If the answer is no, I suppose the court can get to the next issue if it wants. It's advisory. But if the answer is no, the case is dismissed. How can you proceed without personal jurisdiction? But you're disagreeing with me, so I must be wrong.
Because the court, if there's no remedy here, this is almost like a habeas corpus issue. If the state can engage in misconduct, if the state cannot follow the law, and the child becomes the victim of that, that is fundamentally unfair. And since liberty is an issue here, a criminal record is an issue, that's got to be wrong. The Flores case that was cited here says, you know, you got to have a remedy. If we're without a remedy, we've got a problem.
So,
dismissing with prejudice because of the conduct of the state.
Mr. Cracker? I'm sorry.
Well, there was you mentioned misconduct. This is that I think is an overstatement in the sense that there was a finding by both courts of sitting on their hands, of negligence, perhaps because of the factually this case is somewhat unique. But what you're asking, as Justice Bradley is indicating, is the home run in this court. This court is only going to address no personal jurisdiction. But then the question is, we're supposed to mandate that the state cannot charge your client.
I believe so, because I think the Court of Appeals called it official unlawfulness. And to have a right without a remedy makes no sense. For my client to be the damaged person because the state didn't do what it was clearly unequivocally obligated to do is fundamentally unfair. And this court, that's why it is the highest court, has the power and the tools to fashion a remedy for that fundamentally unfair situation. My light says I must leave. Thank you.
Thank you for all your questions. You can come back for your 5-minute rebuttal. Christopher Wren, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Wren.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Christopher Wren. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I appear on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, State of Wisconsin. I want to get to a couple of factual questions after I sort of outline what I hope this court will do in its opinion. I have 3 points that I would like the court to deal with when it writes its opinion. The first is to affirm the Court of Appeals holding that the juvenile court acquired personal jurisdiction over Henry Ofterhauer, whether by the filing of the petition, which is the Court of Appeals view in paragraph 25 of its opinion, or because, under our alternative view, under the mail rule rebuttable presumption, Mr. Ofterhauer received, via statutorily authorized mail service, both the summons and the delinquency petition. When deciding this personal jurisdiction issue, we ask that the court hold that the acquisition of personal jurisdiction does not require physical presence in court, and in addition, that the court reaffirm the vitality of the mail rule rebuttable presumption.
Counsel, what does that do to the statute, 938-273? That basically, doesn't that gut the statute? I mean, if we were to hold that way, then why would there be any reason to comply with the statute?
938-237, I think it is.
938-273.
Right. Actually, it has two components to it. The first component is how you serve it, and the statute says that you serve it by sending it by mail. That's what the court did here. That's what the juvenile court did. The district attorney did not mail it. The statute provides that the juvenile court sends the mailing of the summons and the petition. That's what happened here.
Then you go on, and I don't want
to... Then the next question is, what does the juvenile do in response to that? If the juvenile does not show up, then you kick in the additional procedure to get him personally into court. That's how the presumption works. The presumption is he got the mailing. Then the question is, after he got the mailing, did he show up? The answer is no. What the court did wrong here was not follow the second part of that statute, which was it did not continue the initial hearing, the plea hearing, and do either the personal service or the service by certified mail. But that does not mean that they didn't follow the statute in terms of the initial mailing of the petition. And effect service.
Counsel, I think under our regular civil statutes, you can mail things now by regular mail. And if you don't get an acknowledgement back, you don't have personal jurisdiction just because you mailed it. You either got to get the acknowledgement back or you got to go around and serve someone by another method that's set out in the statute. And to me, what you're asking us to do is to treat juveniles with less concern than we treat a civil person in court who gets more notice than that before personal jurisdiction is deemed to vest in the court.
Well, I'm not sure what... My understanding of the ways of obtaining personal jurisdiction is that there are basically five ways now that have been laid out in various statutes or case law. And if you don't mind, I'll just sort of summarize those so we can address them.
Uh-huh.
The first one, which is the way the Court of Appeals here defined it, was that the filing of the petition creates personal jurisdiction.
Where do you find that?
That's in paragraph 25 of the opinion here. They said that filing the petition in the juvenile court affected personal jurisdiction.
I thought you were going to give me statutory...
They based it on this court's ruling in Smith. In fact, the juvenile statute, neither the juvenile statute nor the criminal statutes specify how personal jurisdiction gets acquired. That's all specified by court rulings. In the civil area, and for instance in municipal court proceedings, the statutes explain how to obtain personal jurisdiction.
Right. Don't you think these statutes here are meant to say how to get personal jurisdiction over the juvenile? Don't you think that's why certified mail or personal service is required?
No, I don't think that's the reason at all. And
really?
Really, yes.
Well, you know, if you can just send it to him by mail and it doesn't come back, and that's all the assurances you need to know that he knows and has had notice of the proceedings that's going on, why would you want to take that second step?
Because the statute requires it. I don't think
so. No, why does it require it? I guess that's what I'm asking you.
I think it's requiring it to take the additional step simply to say, in the juvenile context, we're going to go one step more than we actually have to. I mean, and looking through the personal jurisdiction statutes, or not the statutes, but case law and so on, one thing that struck me was, and this court said this in Smith. I'll see if I can find it real quickly for you.
That's Smith here. So tell me what page.
That's what I'm trying to specifically find here. Oh, I think it would be around page 239. I think that's it. One of the things this court said in Smith was that personal jurisdiction assures that the defendant has a sufficient relationship to the jurisdiction exercising authority, and that the defendant has notice of the charges.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say that the defendant has to have notice via certified mail. Our view is that if you say that the mail service, when it doesn't come back, is not sufficient to effect personal jurisdiction, regardless of what the statute says you do after that, you're basically undermining the mail rule presumption. I don't see how, under the circumstances here, that when Mr. Ofterhauer had the opportunity in court to testify that he did not receive that mailing and did not say a word, the court then found that the mailings had gone out and he had received them.
Because let's assume for sake of this question that we agree with.
Okay.
The mail service is sufficient to confer jurisdiction. Let's assume we agree with that.
Right.
I'm reading now from your brief,
right,
at page 10, where it indicates that on the petition was filed on October 26, 2001. The summons was filed in Walworth County Circuit Court for initial appearance on November 8th, on October 31st, 2001. The summons and delinquency petition were mailed by regular mail to Alt-Dahar, at the Whitewater home address by Walworth County Juvenile Court Clerk Loretta Minel. The summons and the petition do not come back. Now, that's in your brief.
That's correct.
The petition, the portion that says that something went to Hot Springs and came back was the juvenile referral, not the summons. So, giving you the benefit of the doubt with respect to the mailbox rule,
yes,
if you don't send it to where the defendant is, and the defendant is in Hot Springs, Montana, how do you obtain jurisdiction?
Because the address they did send it to was an address that they had that was from which they could expect that he would receive it through mail forwarding. If it came back, then we'd be in this position where it came back from Hot Springs.
So the last known address is not sufficient, at least your argument is not required. You only have to send it to a address, and as long as you send it to a address, that's sufficient?
An address at which they have reason to believe that he lives. And that was the address they received from Jefferson County.
Of course, they knew he didn't reside there. I mean, there was knowledge that he wasn't there.
Not on this prosecutor. No, that's not correct. The petition that was sent out by the juvenile court. If there's an error here, it was by the juvenile court, I think, because what the prosecutor did was take the address that was referred to them from Jefferson County, put that in the petition, and the court clerk testified that when she mails out the summons and the petition, she relies on the address that's found on the petition. What happened in a separate part of the juvenile court before that was that the juvenile court officer apparently had this address in Hot Springs. And just as a factual matter, I did a check on where that address in Hot Springs was located. I didn't get a sense that it was anywhere out in some rural area. It was downtown, about a half mile from a post office station there in Hot Springs. But what's going on here is not that the prosecutor was sending it to a bad address or an intentionally bad address. The prosecutor was sending it to the address that she knew. The juvenile court had a different address that it was using. The juvenile court's address, material mailed there, came back undelivered. It didn't come back to the prosecutor. The things the notice that was sent out to Whitewater did not come back. And under the mail rule, regardless of whether it's through forwarding or through the direct receipt at that address, if it doesn't come back, the presumption is it was received.
So you think
our position
by regular mail, that's you obtain personal jurisdiction. Once the petition and the summons are filed and mailed to a address and they are not returned, that's the end of the story for personal jurisdiction.
For personal jurisdiction, that does not say that the court can then do things in absentia. The question, to me, and this is what I was trying to get to in terms of this whole question of personal jurisdiction, I think the issue of personal jurisdiction and notice have been kind of conflated, kind of merged together, smooshed together in a way that's not necessary to understand either. Due process for purposes of getting the court to be able to do something to somebody requires basically three things. One, the court has to have subject matter jurisdiction. Second, it has to have personal jurisdiction. And then third, there has to be notice to the individual who is the subject of the proceeding. Personal jurisdiction, in a number of the cases, suggests to me that personal jurisdiction is really a notice to the court that it will have the authority to exercise power over that individual once additional steps are done to make sure the individual knows. That notice is really sort of a two-pronged thing. That personal jurisdiction attaches when the complaint is filed, the summons is filed, or the petition is filed, as a matter of due process. Not necessarily as a matter of statute, but as a matter of due process. That it's when you file it, it has to contain enough information that alerts the court to its own subject matter jurisdiction and to the fact that this individual has enough attachment to that jurisdiction that it can exercise authority over it. It also has to advise, have enough information in there to suggest that there's enough notice when it's sent to the individual that the individual will know what's going on. there's a separate due process notice requirement to the individual, which is they have to get it. They have to have notice of the thing. And it can be constructive notice under the civil statutes. I mean, the person doesn't even have to have actual notice. And that and it doesn't even have to show up in a civil proceeding. You can get a default judgment if the person doesn't show up. I think the civil proceedings suggest that appearance in court is not a due process obligation. It may be imposed by statute. It's not imposed by statute here. It may just be something that, as I tried to suggest in my brief when I was going back through the cases that have decided that in the criminal context, an individual has to be in front of the court in order to have jurisdiction, that does not rest on cases that have actually said that. The cases have simply involved situations where the person did appear and challenged the jurisdiction, and then the court said, well, you're here, we have jurisdiction. But that's been transmogrified over the years into a statement that it's required. What I think personal appearance is related to the notice aspect in the sense that if the person doesn't show up after receiving notice, then the court can't do anything until the person gets in there. But the purpose of subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction at the outset is to alert the court to its authority to do the next thing. It's sort of like in a computer, that personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction would be the booting program to get the computer to start up and running. And then notice and the other things are what actually get the whole process moving.
You know, I noticed when Justice Butler was asking Attorney Kreck about what was mailed to Montana, and he initially said he thought the summons and delinquency petition were.
No.
Well, he wasn't sure about it. You're shaking your head.
It was not. It was not.
So it's just the waiver that was sent to Montana, right?
It was the waiver that was sent. It also turns out this is part of the thing about, you know, well, they should have sent it to Montana, to the Montana address. Well, if they'd sent it to the Montana address, we know it would have come back undelivered. Now, that might have triggered some other things to do, but at least at this point, we know that the street address was not a valid address, at least for mail delivery. They sent a certified letter later out of the criminal side of the prosecutor's office about a month later to that same street address. It came back undelivered. So I don't think it's fair to fault the prosecutor, who doesn't have the responsibility for sending this stuff out in the first place, to fault the prosecutor for not mailing it to an address from which things were coming back already undelivered. The first time they got a post office box was when the juvenile officer from Montana initiated the contact with the prosecutor's office and provided the P.O. box. The waiver petition and then a follow-up waiver notice was sent to the P.O. box. Those didn't come back either. Under Mr. Kreck's standard, that doesn't have any effect. The mail rule doesn't matter. So what we have is that we send a petition to an address, it doesn't come back. We presume it's forwarded because under the mail rule, we presume that the post office does what it says it's going to do, and the post office says we will forward it if we have a forwarding order, otherwise we'll return it as undelivered. It doesn't come back. We send it to a known good address that where the person's living. It comes back undelivered. That's obviously not going to be sufficient for postal service. Later on, we get another address, a post office box. It's sent there. It doesn't come back. Now, does the mail rule apply or not? We know that that's a good address. That's the address he's giving. It doesn't come back. Presumably, under Mr. Kreck's rationale, that doesn't matter either.
Counselor, does the failure to send out the materials by certified mail or serve them personally affect the competency of the court to waive him into into adult court?
Here's where this is one of the three things that I wanted the court to deal with in its when it writes its opinion, and I'll just get back to that real quickly. It doesn't affect the validity of the waiver petition itself. The waiver petition can be filed before personal jurisdiction ever attaches, even under Mr. Kreck's theory, because the petition gets filed. The waiver petition can be filed as simultaneously with the delinquency petition itself. And that occurs before, even under Mr. Kreck's theory, the attachment of personal jurisdiction. So the issue of whether it invalidates the waiver petition, I think, that's not correct. The waiver petition is still valid. What's not valid in the state's view is the waiver order. And the reason it's not valid is because a hearing in absentia on a waiver is permissible only when the juvenile has absconded and does not appear at the waiver hearing. The court, Judge Carlson, I believe it was, did find that he absconded. Judge Kennedy did not review that, overturn it. He treated that, in effect, as law of the case. The court of appeals, we did not defend it, the absconding issue in the court of appeals. Court of appeals held that he had not absconded. I'm not arguing that he absconded.
Okay.
Therefore, because the waiver hearing itself did not comply with the statute, the order itself is
invalid.
It does not invalidate the waiver petition. The waiver petition is still a separate question. They raised the question, tried to raise the question in the Court of Appeals as to the sufficiency of the waiver petition. That is, the court refused to hear that. The Court of Appeals refused to hear that. That's not been discussed in this court, and that awaits further proceedings in the juvenile court, depending on what this court does here. But we do agree that the waiver order itself is not valid and that this court should vacate that. What the remedy is for that was a lot of what I think you were talking about with Mr. Craig. Our position is that in the absence of intentional manipulation, we don't believe there's any intentional manipulation here at all. I think the chronology itself shows that there was no intentional manipulation.
Regarding remedy, Mr. Wren, if I could ask, your position regarding, at least what the United States Supreme Court has said in Doggett versus United States, a case where when the federal government failed to arrest a person that was unaware of an indictment for 8.5 years, the defendant was presumptively prejudiced by the delay and was not required to demonstrate actual prejudice. And the remedy was dismissal with prejudice.
Our position is he did know. And that depends on what you decide to do with the mail rule. If you decide not to apply the mail rule here, then presumably he didn't have notice. Our position is he did have notice. Our position is he also, I think the Court of Appeals also held that he had constructive notice via the waiver petition, which referenced the delinquency petition itself. In either event, he had sufficient notice of what was going on here. So it's not as if, as you say in Doggett, he didn't know. Here he knew, he just ignored.
Well, let's say we find that he did not know. He did not get notice, and we say there was not compliance with the statute. Let's just say then the other question was, well, what do we do with the second part? I'm talking about, he's now 19 years old. Right. What, does the state still have jurisdiction?
I think it's DWB, that if the petition had been filed before he becomes an adult, but isn't brought into the court until after he's an adult, the juvenile court still has jurisdiction. So our position is that when you invalidate the waiver order, it goes back to the juvenile court. It goes back to the point at which the error occurred, which was they did not send out they did not effect personal service or send it out by certified mail. And then it proceeds from there. So basically we're moving it back to a kind of a nunk-pro-tunk kind of situation. And I think that's where it would go. At this point, the waiver petition, actually what happens with the waiver petition is you may not even get to that. I'm not exactly sure how the statute plays out. But as I understand it, the waiver petition basically preempts other aspects of the juvenile justice code. In other words, you would not get to a plea hearing, for instance. You don't get to that hearing until the waiver issue is resolved. So really what it's going to go back to is to the waiver hearing at which these other issues can be raised as to whether the waiver petition was filed for purposes of intentional manipulation of jurisdiction.
Mr. Wren, let me ask you this. What if the state at this point were to dismiss the juvenile proceedings, asking the court to dismiss without prejudice? Could you then charge in adult court? Six-year statute of limitations.
I believe you could. It's a six-year statute of limitations on, I think, five of the charges, which are felonies. Two of them are misdemeanors. I can't remember. I think that's a three-year statute. I don't recall what the statute is. Those might be out the window. But
what about the tolling out of state?
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, I haven't looked at that. I know in talking in terms of whether there's been any how this has all played out here. And under the juvenile code, there's 938.315, which talks about delays, continuances, and so on. And there is a provision there that says that you exclude any period of delay resulting from the absence or unavailability of the juvenile. Now, Mr. Crack is focused on the unavailability. We would talk about the absence, which doesn't imply any kind of, you know, activity, negligence on anybody's part. In addition, in terms of the issue of whether delay and so on affects subject matter or personal jurisdiction, I'd note subsection 3 of that same statute, which reads, and I quote, failure to comply with any time limit specified in this chapter does not deprive the court of personal or subject matter jurisdiction or of competency to exercise that jurisdiction. So I think by statute the legislature has answered the question about what even failure to comply with a time limit. Here we didn't even have a time limit with which we had to comply. So to find that this is somehow, there's somehow been such a fundamental unfairness in this procedure that it requires dismissal with prejudice, I think, is not correct. In addition, the juvenile code confers on the juvenile court the decision about whether to dismiss with prejudice or without prejudice, and I think that it's inappropriate for an appellate court to decide something that's relegated to the juvenile court's authority, particularly in this regard.
Mr. Wren, if you could point me in the right direction, the statute upon which you rely for the mailbox rule.
There's no statute for the mailbox rule.
You're not applying the civil mailbox rule.
No, I'm relying on a century's worth of case law from this court, as well as you know, the federal courts have held the same kind of thing.
And the reason I ask the question is because my recollection of that general body of law is that the mailbox rule applies when it's sent to the last known address. But if the last known address is not where this document went, I'm not sure the mailbox rule applies.
Well, I don't know about the last known address. If it's mailed to an address where the sender has a reasonable expectation that the recipient will receive it, I think is a sufficient standard. I don't recall any of the cases saying that it has to be the last known address, so long as it's intended for receipt. We know that this address that it was sent to was a good address where they had lived, and that it was sent within the time within which the Postal Service will either forward it, if there's a forwarding order, or will return it as undeliverable.
And I'm not aware of the mailbox rule ever applying a forwarding aspect to it. Are you aware of cases that allow for that?
I have not seen them like that, but I don't know if
it either.
Yeah, but the mailbox rule itself is predicated on the idea that the Postal Service does its job and does its job according to the standards that it sets. And I think that's what's going on here.
But isn't part of the problem with that the assumption that a person leaves a forwarding address with the Postal Service? That's not always the case.
That's correct, but the Postal Service in its procedure says if we don't have a forwarding address, we return it as undeliverable.
Yeah, it's only if the people that get it give it back to the post office, though. I mean, if it's delivered to your house and you pitch it in the trash because you don't want to be bothered, that's the end of it.
And that's a similar kind of thing with substituted service. If somebody, substituted service is perfectly valid, but if you give it to somebody who decides, I don't like this guy, I'm going to toss him in the trash, that's still...
At least you've got a record of who you gave it to, though.
Well, what you have here is a record of who you, of having mailed it, which is all that's required under the mail rule. That it's been deposited, that the evidence is there that it's been deposited, and it's a rebuttable presumption. It wasn't as if he was required to say, oh yeah, they told me they sent it, they told me I received it, I guess I got to sit here and live with it. He was in court, he had the opportunity to get up and say, I did not receive it, here's why I didn't receive it. He never did that. He sat there silently. There's no evidence in the record at all to rebut that these mailings were received. They weren't rebutted in terms of the post office box, which we know is an address that they're saying they receive stuff at. And it wasn't rebutted in terms of the address in Whitewater. It was rebutted, in effect, by the return from the street address in Hot Springs, Montana. The non-deliverability is, in effect, a rebuttal, rebuts the presumption that it was delivered. We don't have that rebuttal here on either the summons and delinquency petition or the waiver petition.
Mr. Wren, one of the things that hasn't been dealt with yet in the argument, I think by either party, is the purpose for the delay of over 500 days. Is that anywhere on the record?
I think you can infer it from part of the argument that was made. The prosecutor noted that basically the job was to show that it was not intentional manipulation. And basically the prosecutor said, in effect, we weren't trying to manipulate. We had been asked, in effect, to take this and hold it in case he came back. He didn't come back. So we didn't do anything on it. And what changed it was the call from the Montana authorities saying, he's doing the same kind of stuff out here. Will you take him back? At which point, that's when they filed the waiver petition.
Do you agree that it's incumbent upon this court to apply the Barker versus Wengo and the Doggett analysis in determining whether or not the delay was justified or not?
I haven't looked at those in connection with this case anyway, and it's been a while since I've looked at them.
Otherwise, we have to look at the length of the delay, the reason, the assertion of the right, and any prejudice to the defendant.
Well, I suppose I think that what you set up is a situation where the burden of production is on them to say this is presumptively wrong. The standard you set is intentional manipulation. And I think that the intentional manipulation is a finding of fact that's made by the trial court based on what it gets in front of it. What it got in front of it and what just Judge Kennedy said, which I thought was useful, is don't look at the whole 502 days to determine whether you've got intentional manipulation. Break it down into the period between the filing of the petition and when he turned 17, and when he turned 17 and when the waiver was filed, and then when the waiver is filed, when they get the information to when the waiver itself is filed. And what you find out is that if they had been intentionally manipulating, they wouldn't have waited another 221 days to file a waiver petition.
Now, I may be wrong, but you used the term intentionally manipulating as being the standard. I thought the standard was whether or not the delay was unjustified or unreasonable. Am I stating that wrong?
Well, the Montgomery is about what Montgomery, as I understand it, has said, is that it takes intentional manipulation before you can preclude waiver. I don't think it necessarily talks about whether there's an overly long delay. I think that the question is why. And the answer to the why here is essentially he wasn't in Wisconsin. They weren't going to press it unless he came back. Now, that's not intentional manipulation. In addition, some of those two intentional manipulation issues have arisen in cases where there's a question about the actual filing of the delinquency petition itself in relation to the waiver age. Here, he was always within the waiver age, and the delinquency petition itself was filed as quickly as they could file it after they got the referral. They filed it within the 20-day standard of the statute. The question is, with the waiver petition was then, and I will say, he would have, I think Mr. Kreck is right, had he shown up at the time of that original hearing, he would not have been waived in. They were content to go forward. That's why they didn't file the waiver petition at that point. They filed the waiver petition when it became clear that he, in the other jurisdiction, he was also engaging in the same kind of conduct. And that I think is part of the reason that the Court of Appeals said that's the only inference they could draw was that Mr. Ofterhauer himself had been the catalyst for the filing of the waiver petition, not anything that the state was trying to do to manipulate his presence in the adult criminal court. So part of the thing about the intentional manipulation, which none of us have briefed and really, but it's kind of lying under there, is what evidence can a court rely on in deciding whether there has been intentional manipulation? I think what Judge Kennedy did here was say, in effect, I'm looking at this time period. I'm looking at how the state actually acted when it was handling this waiver issue. And one of the things I see is they didn't file a waiver like the day after or the week after he turned 17. They filed a waiver after they received information, and very quickly after they received information, that he engaged in similar kind of conduct elsewhere. And at that point, that's when it changed the calculus. And the Court of Appeals, anyway, has said in other cases that a change of that sort is sufficient to justify a change in the decision about whether to do a waiver. So I think that's what's going on in the intentional. I don't think that the time itself is a sufficient thing to I don't think that's the standard in this case. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. Mr. Kreck.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Justice Butler, If you look at 938-273-1, right in the middle of it, it talks about if you're going to do certified mail, it's to the last known address. It doesn't say that in the first sentence, but I guess we've got to apply some common sense that the mail has to be to the last known address. And I think the sort of mailbox thing is a red herring. The mailbox rule, if there is such a thing, is an evidentiary rule that there's a presumption that if something's mailed that it doesn't come back, that it was delivered. We're not about that at all here. Since I'm not a specialist in practicing all kinds of areas of law, I realize that there are varying standards of delivery of process for various things. For instance, I can't, as a lawyer, deliver an order to show cause for contempt in a divorce case for something as simple as failure to pay child support without personally serving the order to show cause on the individual, even if he or she is represented by counsel. And I've cited to the statute that requires that unequivocally in Wisconsin. I can't start a civil action in Wisconsin without serving the summons and complaint personally on the defendant. And substituted service means that the process server serves somebody who is of a certain age and is identified, and if there becomes an issue later on in the case when someone brings an action for default judgment, then we take evidence on that subject. Much has been made about the fact that we didn't produce Mr. Ofterhauer to testify that he didn't get it. Any defense attorney worth his salt wouldn't have put Mr. Ofterhauer up there to say, I didn't get it and I can't explain to you why, because the court could simply then, and the prosecutor could ask a lot of questions and they could reach some credibility issue that, well, I didn't like the way he looked when he said that or whatever the case may be. This isn't about that. This is about the fact that judges in Wisconsin need to bring young people in before them and say, this is your first appearance, and we need to do something about what you did. That's what 938-273 mandates. This case doesn't pass the smell test. If you punish William for the state's failure to do what it clearly should have done, we point to the clerk here. Come on. I'm a practicing attorney. When I want to get jurisdiction over the person I'm prosecuting, or if I'm a plaintiff, or if I want to go to the defendant, it's my obligation to tell the court what the statute is and ask the court to do it and ensure that the court does it. It's not the clerk's job. It's not the judge's job. It's my job as a lawyer to make sure that's done. So for the state to try to shift this to the clerk or the court is just plain wrong. And the state shouldn't benefit by delaying this case, by not doing what is clearly mandated by the law, by sitting on its hands, and then waiting around so that my client, who is 15 years old, doesn't get the benefit of the juvenile court system. That doesn't pass the smell test. And when that happens, this court is a court that looks at fundamental fairness and constitutional rights, can fashion a remedy so prosecutors will diligently do their job, will say, well, he didn't show up. Your Honor, you need to adjourn this. And we're going to get a deputy out there to serve him at school, or we're going to get a process server. The statute even says that my client would have had to pay for it if they did that. It says in sub 3 that the expense of service is on the parents and the child. How fundamentally unfair to put the burden of service on the person being prosecuted. That's like putting the burden of proving the facts on the person on the rack. It's just fundamentally unfair. This is a case where if you open up Jermaine, you're not taking and opening up the crack in the door. You're kicking down the door off its hinges. Prosecutors have to follow the statutes of the state of Wisconsin. That's fundamental to what we do.
Thank you, Mr. Kreck, and thank you, Mr. Wren, for your arguments today in this juvenile case relating to service and waiver. And that concludes our hearing in 03-2820 CR. The court is in recess till tomorrow morning at 9:45 for further oral argument, and we'll meet in the conference room for conference at 3:15.
Sorry, 3:15.